ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming is expanding to keep pace with your world.
Because keeping up can be a challenge.
And events can feel overwhelming beyond our understanding.
What might Xi Jinping do next?
What hand is Trump hiding?
Join me, Hamish McDonald, Geraldine Doogue, Latika Burke and Kylie Morris.
Four voices bringing perspective, experience and energy to the big global stories.
Global roaming, weekdays at 11 on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen.
Journalist and TV icon Ray Martin, unionist, First Nations advocate and author Thomas Mayo, two influential voices, two very different life journeys, both diving into one uncomfortable truth. Today on Big Ideas. On ABC Radio National, ABC Listen and as podcast, hello, Natasha Mitchell with the show that gives you this special front row seat at events starring big thinkers. And when we sit with what's uncomfortable, really sit with it, deeply listen in that discomfort, big shifts can happen. In two clear-eyed presentations today, Ray and Thomas are inviting you to do just that as they cleave open what it's like to be Indigenous to a place that hasn't reckoned with its recent past and with racism. Coming up, Ray Martin will give the Joan Kerner social justice oration. First, Curureg Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander man Thomas Mayo. He's the award-winning author of Always Was, Always Will Be, Finding the Heart of the Nation, and Dear Son, Letters and Reflections from First Nations Fathers and Sons, which has been turned into a stage play, by the way. Thomas is presenting the inaugural Walilyup Oration held in WA in Fremantle at the Focus First Nations Film Festival on Noongar Country, the traditional lands of the Whadjuk people.
Kapukut Murabuwai, good afternoon, my people. Those words are in the language of a Torres Strait Kalalagau Ya. In 2021, I published a letter to my son in an anthology called Dear Son, Letters and Reflections from First Nations Fathers and Sons. The 12 letters in the anthology were written by men such as Stan Grant, who wrote to his boys about his father, his bubbin in Wiradjuri, and how, in his footsteps, they would use language to revitalise connections to family and country. Troy Cassar-Daly, the popular Gumbangia country music singer, wrote to his son Clay about the love and affection he has for his mum. Troy wrote about broken families and the inevitable trial and error we go through when building and maintaining relationships. Daniel Morrison, a bit more local, also made a contribution, a Yamatji Noongar man who lives up Perth. He wrote about how hard it was for him to come out to his children as a gay man and how loving their response was. Charlie King was another contributor, a legendary ABC personality in my hometown of Darwin, who posthumously wrote to his white father. Charlie revisited the love story his father had told him about when he met his mother, a love story that united two very different lives. In his youth, Charlie set out to ride a bike around Australia from Melbourne, promoting the Melbourne Star bicycle brand. As he approached his most northern waypoint, he almost died from the boiling tropical humidity. Darwin Hospital was the unintended end of his journey because of heatstroke. The ride around Australia also ended in Darwin because his riding mate had literally shot himself in the leg. Unbeknownst to Charlie's father, his fellow rider had secretly strapped the gun to his leg as he rode because he was told that Aboriginal people are all cannibals. Fortunately, the adventure led to romance and marriage, not just injury. Charlie's mother was a nurse at the hospital. When his father came to, he thought he had died and gone to heaven, and the angels were Aboriginal. Charlie's mother, a Gurindji woman, was stolen from country on horseback when she was a child, though eventually she returned home. It was decades later, on horseback again, but this time with the love of her life, Charlie's dad. Underpinning each of the stories the 12 men shared in letters to their sons and fathers including those stories that celebrated resilience, solidarity, humour, and success, was racism. They wrote how they were personally affected by racism, and they gave examples. There were the stolen generations that Charlie and others wrote about. There was the name-calling, the hate speech, from boyhood to fatherhood to the day that pen was put to paper. Joel Bayliss from South Australia wrote about the effect of stereotypes in the media. His example was the disgustingly racist political cartoons we've seen in papers like The Australian. He wrote about the Bill Leak cartoon from 2016. That cartoon, to remind you just how racist it was, depicted an Indigenous man, beer in hand, indifferently facing a police officer who held an Aboriginal boy by the scruff of the neck. It implied that the man was the father of the boy, and because he was Indigenous, he did not know his son's name, nor did he care for him. Normalising racism against Indigenous Australians has paved the way for the worst injustices that are still felt today. The stereotypes in mainstream media have a numbing effect on the empathy towards First Nations people. The bombardment of derogatory media, the language used in headlines and reports, the prominence of articles about misdeeds by an Aboriginal person versus the burying of an article about a blatant injustice against one of us is a conscious decision, not random racism. The Intervention from 2007 is an example, an act so racist that the Anti-Racial Discrimination Act was suspended in order to target remote Aboriginal communities. It followed a campaign to prepare Australians for what would happen. We were labelled as lazy bungs, savages, implying that we're all drunks who don't care about our kids, and then they pulled the trigger. The intervention, the government claimed, was about child abuse, as if child abuse is not a societal issue, but an Aboriginal problem. In the execution of the policy, the Australian Army was mobilised into our communities. The powers of Parliament gave the government enabled yet another barrage of dispossession and disempowerment. The whole performance of white superiority over impoverished blackfellas was beamed into the homes of millions of Australians, and barely a whimper of protest came from them. I had three kids at the time. Indigenous fathers like me felt the suspicious eyes on us when we held our babies, not just in the Northern Territory, but here in Western Australia and throughout the rest of the country. It seemed that Australians believed the stereotypes they were taught, that our children need protection from their Indigenous fathers. What an irony this is when you consider that this country locks up Aboriginal children at incredibly disproportionate rates. In government facilities, our children are being tortured and traumatised as if their families for generations haven't been through enough, children as young as 10. The letter to my son, which became a book when I invited the other men's perspectives, was an act of defiance through love. The youngest of my children at the time was only 7 years old, and as I wrote to them, I dared to hope that through our writing and the truth-telling efforts of many others, such as the great filmmakers who are here this weekend, that racism could be on the decline. I remind you that I wrote Dear Son in 2021. In 2026, I think you'll agree, the racism against First Nations people has become worse, especially since the 2023 voice referendum. The Bill Leak type cartoons are not just an occasional publication. I was subject to a similar racist cartoon published by the Australian Financial Review during the referendum campaign, a cartoon depicting me in raggedy jeans dancing a jig for a white man for money. Today, racism is not just in our faces on the streets. The hatred screams at us on our phones through social media. Our feeds are saturated with racist comments, posts, and memes. But I want everybody to take a step back for a moment, though. Let's step up to the escarpment to watch the broader social landscape. The Bondi Massacre was a horrific act of racism against Jews, and with the abhorrent Israeli brutalisation of Palestinians in Gaza, sadly, anti-Semitism is on the rise. Islamophobia is on the rise as well. Muslims have been subject to the same type of stereotypes that Indigenous Australians have suffered from, propagated in the media for many years across much of Western society. We've seen targeted racism and degradation of the character of Australian Asians, Indians and Africans as well. It is obvious that anyone of colour, anyone with an accent or cultural difference is being dehumanised, separated, othered. Beyond race, though, and this is an important observation, people are being asked to pick a side. We've witnessed where such tribalism and dogmatic debate can lead to over in the United States. Republican versus Democrat, my interpretation of the Bible against yours, MAGA, or you're out. It's scary, isn't it? Why, we should ask, is the polarisation of society getting worse? And most importantly, who's behind it and why are they doing it? I believe the media is a large part of the problem. We must scrutinise who owns the media, though, and who is pulling the strings. Australia has the second highest rate of media concentration in the world. Rupert Murdoch, a citizen of the United States of America, owns a majority of it. There are only a handful of others who own our significant media, and they control what we see on TV, what we hear on the radio, the popular culture that we consume, even what we know of current events. The tech bros, through their algorithms, dictate what we see on social media feeds. The algorithms are designed to inflame our emotions for clicks, to entrench us into a cycle that experts are warning are leading to hatred, misogyny, and violence. Studies have shown, for example, that a new social media account identifying a boy or a man receives content that is derogatory towards other genders in only a matter of minutes. I'm a progressive male. I'm a human rights advocate, and I've been fighting against racism my whole life. I've learned from experts that the more often we share, the longer we view, and the more we click the type of content that angers us, the more of it we're likely to see. In response to that, for more than a year now, the moment I see racist posts or sensationalist headlines from the Murdoch media or conservative commentators, I don't interact with them. I block them or use the option to hide similar posts as quick as I can. And yet still they keep coming. Posts promoting Pauline Hanson, news reports with subtle but obvious racist stereotyping, men telling me that women cannot be trusted, telling me that to be masculine is to be devoid of empathy and feeling and care. If this is my experience on social media, imagine what everyone else is being fed. From everything I have seen and read in my efforts to understand the motivations behind these powerful people who are using their wealth to manipulate hearts and minds, I can only deduce that they just want more money and power. It's that simple, really. It's greed. While Australians are divided and blaming each other for our problems, pointing fingers at our differences, we're paying little attention to the fact that 34 Australian billionaires are increasing their wealth to the tune of $600,000 a day. I can't comprehend how so much wealth is never enough, nor why, in the pursuit of more, they would use their power to actively divide those who might stand in the way of their profits, because we dare to want a world in which we can breathe in, to demand good hospitals and education and fairness and justice, and we want all of us, not just some, to be able to afford it. We must resist what I hope you can see clearly in the landscape of Australia. We are not each other's enemy. We are being played for fools. In order to resist and stand together, our most urgent task is to stop ignoring the racism against Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. How we treat the First Peoples is foundational to our struggle for fairness for all. We stand in solidarity with all Australians when they experience hate, but we can't help but wonder why more Australians don't stand with us. Where were my fellow Australians when we cried for Cleveland Dodd a child locked up in an adult prison for 87 days, who was cut off from his family and who pleaded for help before losing his life in that place. That was an act of hate. Cassius Turvey and the Aboriginal kids who have since that tragedy been hunted down by vigilantes. Those are acts of hate. The deaths in custody, the highest number in 1 year was last year, since the Royal Commission back in 1988. Those are acts of hate. The Don Dale scandal, the ongoing torturous conditions in prisons like Banksia here in WA, the media who is always normalising it, that is an act of hate. The fact that almost all of the time, all of the children in youth detention are Indigenous kids, that is an act of hate. This shameful set of facts about our country, Australia, goes beyond the influence of billionaires and the media. It speaks about us as Australians, all of us in our backyards, how we act, what we choose to do. No other Australians experience systemic racism in the way that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people do. Racism in our health system, racism in our schools, racism in sport, racism in the justice system and the parliaments, racism in the recollection of history and the interpretation of why there is such a massive gap in outcomes today. Racism on the goddamn streets just outside our homes. The saddest observation I've made over the years is that no one has fought harder to improve our communities than ourselves. We've worked hard, collaboratively, with humility and grace. Elders and our excellent experts in all their fields have researched, agitated, raised funds to go to parliaments and state capitals in Canberra, invited all Australians to walk with us for constitutional change. We've articulated the problems to governments and politicians of all ilks, and at times good policy and programs have been achieved. But the heartbreak, we struggle and sacrifice, and where there is change for good, change back to the status quo is too often just around the corner. I believe that we can be better than this. I believe that when we envisage 2050, we can be an island with peace and abundance for all its inhabitants as we were before colonisation. But we need leadership from those in power. We need them to shake off the temptations of big money and corrupting influence, to break the puppet strings pulled by the wealthy individuals who only care about their selfish interests. The formula to make this happen involves all of us. Put simply, we need people power plus organisations acting plus good government policy multiplied by a healthy dose of consistency. When I say people power, I mean the type of collective action that has led to our successes thus far. Like when we called for the right to vote, we were told no, but we turned that no into yes. Like when we demanded equal wages, we were told no, but we turned that no into yes. Like when we marched for land rights and native title, they said no, but we didn't take no for an answer. We kept on going, bringing more and more Australians with us. We built people power, and eventually we achieved yes. Organisations have a responsibility as well. We need schools to teach the truth of our history. We need unions to continue to act in solidarity. We need hospitals and universities and community groups and NGOs and corporates to stamp out racism and stand loud and proud for social justice. Resist the anti-diversity rubbish. Resist wanton greed. Resist ignorance. Good government policy. Or shouldn't that be obvious? We need policies that ensure self-determination and community empowerment, policies that improve protection of sacred sites and heritage, policies that protect the environment, and policies that take racism against First Nations people as seriously as any others. The final part of the equation is what has always been missing. From time to time, we've had the other parts, people power, organisations acting and good government policy, but we've never had them consistently. We must take action to achieve a sustained act of care from all Australians. We need bipartisanship in Parliament, and we should fight for it. We need responsible leadership, not tribalism. Only then will we close the gap. The government should not ignore the nefarious exploitation of our emotions by the media, and I encourage you to support campaigns that are calling for change. A campaign to address the domination of algorithms that you can join is called Fix Our Feeds. Note it, please look it up. We also need a strong and well-resourced ABC that upholds the integrity and fairness that we expect and deserve from a public broadcaster. We need to do more to keep big money out of politics. We need greater accountability in the media, including a test of the character of the people and companies that are allowed to have ownership. The last appeal I want to make to you and my fellow Australians is to resist the urge to think the worst of each other. Remember what I talked about. There's forces out there that are purposely turning us against each other. And 26 January is one of their favourite times of year. I've often been asked how I can stay calm, keeping hate out of my heart. Especially during the Australia Day debate, journalists have tried for the gotcha moments, expecting me to say that all Australians are racist for another headline about a black fella hating on the rest of Australia. I won't give them what they want. It's just more ammunition to tear us apart. My experience of Australians, who we are, does not match what the mainstream media is pushing on us. The truth is that most Australians are good people. Like us, they want the best for themselves and their families, to be able to enjoy a life where they feel safe, where they can be prosperous, where they can find meaning in all they do. But we must understand what's at play. When people are led to believe they may lose something personal, as they were during the referendum, that they're going to lose their backyards, their access to the beaches, the farms, or opportunities for their children to attend their preferred schools, this barrage of lies and fear-mongering, it causes the reactions that make us feel unwanted. When it comes to 26 January, we're not saying there's nothing to celebrate at all. Just don't dance on our graves. Don't dance on the graves of our ancestors. Have some respect. For us, the day is a day of mourning. Instead of having a go at us, let's come up with solutions. I started this speech talking about proud Aboriginal men who have been defying the stereotypes and racism they've faced. And now I want to finish with the final short letter in Dear Son. This letter is a letter to my dad, and I hope you'll agree it's a succinct summation of why, against the tide of hate, love is the answer. Dear Dad, when I announced I'd become a writer, you said you wouldn't read my books. I wasn't hurt. Instead, I was emboldened. You have always demanded that I mustn't talk about you to anyone, how you managed to survive and provide. But here in this letter, Dad, your modesty will be outdone by my pride. And why shouldn't a son be proud of his father? You've overcome so much. You came from Thursday Island in apartheid Queensland as a young man with nothing. You built a home with your own hands, even though you didn't have any qualifications as a builder. You and Mum did this on one meagre income using aptitude, commitment, and ultimately your love for your children. You taught me to hunt and fish on the reefs and to cook as Torres Strait Islander men do. You taught me good values and discipline. You taught me to always work hard. I have learnt, although your quick temper felt harsh, from your perspective, being hard on me was necessary. You were preparing me for a world that would not love me like you do. You figured that a foot up the backside at home was better than putting a foot wrong outside, where making a poor decision could land me in prison or perhaps 6 foot under the ground. I've idolised you, and with age, I've learnt to follow where you shine the light without walking in your shadows. I am educated, patient, and generous because of you. I'm imperfect like you. And with as many of your lessons as I could gather, I've written a letter to your grandson, a letter to teach him how to be a better dad than we were. And how good would that be? For we are Indigenous fathers and we care for our children. We have loved, nurtured, and provided for them. We have protected them and taught them how to survive and be proud of their culture. We've done as your father did and his father and so on for generations that go back tens of thousands of years. We were the first builders, craftsmen, storytellers, artists, fishermen, hunters, scientists, inventors, explorers, farmers, engineers, warriors and healers. We were not conquerors of each other's lands. We did not strangle Mother Earth. We were her protectors. We are still all of these things and so much more. We are a continuum of proud Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander men, fathers of the longest surviving culture on Earth. And now, Dad, as your hard exterior becomes brittle with age, I feel you. As dusk reaches your eyes, eyes that were too bright to look upon in my youth, I see you. I understand you, Dad. I love you. I will always be your dear son, Thomas. Thank you.
Human rights advocate and author Thomas Mayo, giving the inaugural Walilup oration at the Focus First Nations Film Festival. Walilup is the Indigenous name for Fremantle, where ABC Radio National's Big Ideas comes to you from today in Western Australia. I'm Natasha Mitchell. It's a word derived from the word walio, Noongar for woili, the little kangaroo rat once abundant in the area. We've got two special orations today by two leaders who refuse to accept that polarisation is the only path for a nation like ours, founded on settler colonial violence. But Ray Martin wants us to stop talking and start acting. In this, his 2025 Joan Kerner Social Justice Oration, the Gold Logie winning journalist and television presenter of over five decades, offers a frank account of what he witnessed as a child in rural Australia, as a journalist travelling all over, and also as a founding member of the Council for Aboriginal Reconciliation and former chair of the Australian Indigenous Education Foundation. Here's Ray.
In his address, interesting, in his address to the United Nations General Assembly, the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, making what I think was his finest speech in office so far, Albo had this interesting line. He said, countries that can judge themselves properly by facing a dark history have the opportunity to make reforms. Let me say it again. Countries that can judge themselves properly by facing a dark history have the opportunity to make reforms. And in his inaugural Vincent Lingiari Memorial Lecture in Darwin back in 1996, the then Governor General, William Dean, who I think was arguably our finest Governor General as well, had a similar message. Quoting the great American novelist William Faulkner about race relations, Sir William repeated Faulkner's words, "The past is not dead and gone, it isn't even past. It's absorbed into the present and into the future." Sir William concluded that address poetically, I think, by saying, "When there's no room for national pride or national shame about the past, there can be no national soul." Now, I know there are many examples, but if you want to see the absence or the desperate need for social justice, then spend a couple of days in an Aboriginal community. Northern Territory, WA, Queensland, Victoria, take your pick. Again, to quote the exemplary Sir William Dean, "You can't have true reconciliation without acknowledging the wrongness of past dispossession, oppression, and degradation of Aboriginal peoples." Tonight I want to take you on a bit of a short journey, my personal journey, if you like, towards reconciliation. Certainly for the last 40 years or so, I've been focused personally and professionally, doing my small bit to try and help reconciliation, to close the gap of disadvantage and despair, if you like, for Indigenous Australian people. We're just not closing the gap of social justice. Let me say at the outset, I accept and agree that the Aboriginal problem in Australia, quote unquote, is a really complex one. William Dean once called it the festering sore of Australian society, the Aboriginal problem. Socially and culturally, it's very tricky. Otherwise, it would have been fixed 100 years ago. Financially, it's expensive too. It's very costly. Many people have tried to fix it, politicians and public servants and churches and philanthropists and billionaires and lots of kind people who care, and a few do-gooders as well. Now, countless billions of your taxpayers' dollars have also been thrown at the problem. Pick a figure. Amid poverty, education, housing, jobs, health, welfare, what's the cost of trying to fix those social justice problems in Australia? Because that's what it is. That's what they are. They're all about social justice. How much are we spending? I've seen figures that we spend up to $20 billion a year trying to fix the Aboriginal problem. Mind you, there are no Aboriginal millionaires driving Porsches or in holiday houses in France, so they're obviously not getting the money. So where does all that taxpayer money go? It's certainly not on display across the Aboriginal communities. On the contrary, at Haast Bluff, where I mentioned I go to, every time we arrive, Ken Duncan, the photographer, and I go out there with his wife, and every time we arrive, they're always hungry, especially the kids. So Pam and Ken come out with a truckload of food to give to these people. They're always hungry. They're not guts. They're always just hungry. Catherine and Regional Hospital in the Territory, for example, delivers 200-plus babies a year, plus all the local kids who are sick around there. There is no permanent paediatrician in that area. They either fly in or the mothers are taken to Alice Springs in Darwin for the more difficult births. But in that community, there is no paediatrician for all the kids. Don't tell me, as Pauline does, about how much money they get. As I said, I don't have the answers. I'm just a storyteller. So I'm going to tell you some stories tonight about my personal journey. They're a bit confronting. Maybe together we can start to move forward towards reconciliation and social justice. I grew up in country New South Wales. My father was a motor mechanic who worked on a series of dams that were being built as part of the post-war infrastructure in New South Wales. I lived in 13 different towns before I went to high school. There were always Aboriginal kids at my school. Most of them lived down at the Blacks Camp by the river. No matter the town we went to, it always seemed to be the same. That's where they seem to be, or living on the fringes, always out near the garbage dump. As kids, we played together, but we'd go to my grandmother's place up in Gunnedah in New South Wales for Christmas, just a little wooden working class house in a laneway in town. And every morning, an Aboriginal friend of my grandmother's, a middle-aged woman named Rosie, would drop by after collecting her milk at the shop and having a cup of tea with, she'd have a cup of tea with Grandma. Rosie used to soften her Anzac biscuits by dipping them in the tea. She had no teeth. She always drank from the saucer. Rosie was very shy, and Grandma made sure that we kids were quiet and respectful around Rosie. I was never quite sure why, but we always were. And years later, we discovered that our own great-great-grandmother on my mum's side was an Aboriginal woman, a Camilla Roy Queen, who was born in about 1800 and lived to 104 years of age. Her name was Bootha, and she had a girl and a boy with my Irish Tipperary-born great-great-grandfather, William Lamy, who was sent out here for life after he robbed an Anglican priest of 15 quid. That's how he ended up outside Gunnedah, as a shepherd on a massive sheep property called Keepit Station in about 1830. Their daughter Jane was born in 1838, the year of the nearby Mile Creek Massacre. Their son John was born a little later, the same year as the Waterloo Creek Massacre out near Moree. No shortage of massacres in this country, a few in Victoria's Western District, of course, that we now know about. I later came to suspect that Rosie was somehow a relative. But in the bush in the 1940s and 50s, having an Aboriginal relative was much worse than having a convict as an ancestor. Besides, everybody in town knew that the government inspector took little Aboriginal boys and girls to the home, and they never came back. I remember one January summer's day in Gunnedah. It was blisteringly hot. So my sisters and I had gone to the council swimming pool. We were stretched out in the towels when I noticed the lifeguard hose three boys before they jumped into the pool. I asked my sister why that had happened, and she said, oh, matter-of-factly, they're Aboriginals. That didn't make any sense. The boys were about the same age as me, and I had not been hosed before I jumped in the pool. The kids just copped it, just business as usual, so they hopped in and had a great time, but always it seemed to be separate to the white families. That was life in rural Australia, certainly in New South Wales. It was sort of blatant racism that I see some people nodding that you are familiar with. But you tell people in the cities that, and they don't really believe it happened, and it still happens. For reasons I don't understand now, nobody did anything to change the country's bad habits. We just copped it. We just thought that was business as usual. A year or so into my ABC journalism cadetship, I was graded and I was sent off to Perth. The first thing I did was a radio documentary called The End of the Line. It was about an old empty mining town called Meekatharra, which was at the end of the line up north. That was about, the town was about to be hit by the iron ore boom at the time. But in Western Australia, this New South Wales bush boy suddenly confronted apartheid at work in my own country. Apartheid. It wasn't just the racism that I'd seen in New South Wales. I think it was a Tuesday when I arrived in Meekatharra. It was certainly welfare check day. And about 30 Aboriginal women and men were squatted on the rough dirt median strip outside of the government office in the baking heat for hours until they were finally handed an envelope by a public servant bloke and they were sent away with a wave of a hand. There were two pubs in Meekatharra, one for whites and one for blacks, and no mixing at all. A young Aboriginal clerk at the council told me a story because I asked him, I was looking for interviews, about how he'd been chained to a baobab tree up in Roeburn, just up the road, some years ago by the local copper, accused of stealing cattle, which he hadn't done, he said. He was 13 years old when he was chained to the baobab tree. He told me he was left chained overnight with a pannikin of water, which he accidentally spilt, so he had no water. When the policeman returned the next day with two other young black blokes who were tied to his horse by a rope, he was given a clip around the ear and told to push off. Now, I was appalled that this had happened in Australia, in my country. He just laughed and he said, oh, that's the way it is. That's the way it is. The last recorded massacre of Aboriginal people was at Coniston Cattle Station in the Northern Territory in 1928. Now, there are people here tonight whose parents, not Ron, but people whose parents were alive in 1928. It's as recent as that. The Coniston massacre was led by a police constable. Official records at the time state that 31 men, women and children were slaughtered. Later research suggests it may have been as many as 200 people who were killed. No one went to jail. That's our history that Tony Abbott and others dismiss as black arm history, exaggerated. Well, it's not. We know it's not. There's a research project at Newcastle University funded by the federal government. It's been going for about a decade now. Academics are carefully collating the dozens and dozens and dozens of frontier massacres of Aboriginal people across Australia. That's, they call a massacre incident where more than eight people were killed. And there are dozens and dozens and dozens. Most of them went officially unrecorded. Remember, the Mile Creek massacre I mentioned was the first time any white fella was hanged for murdering black fellas. And that was half a century after the First Fleet arrived in Australia. 50 years of killings and everyone got off at the time. Most of these massacres have, of course, passed down in the oral histories amongst Aboriginal people. Now, these details, as I tell you, I think they really matter. A couple of years ago, I did a documentary on SBS called Mysteries of the Outback for Queensland Tourism. And researching that Outback documentary, I also came across documents that claimed in the 1870s and 1880s, as the Australian states were getting together, our fathers were getting together to plan federation, that 12 of the 14 cattle and sheep stations across the Gulf of Carpentaria had adopted a shoot-on-sight policy for Aborigines they saw. Shoot-on-sight, like dingoes. It was the same, we all know now, in parts of the Territory and Queensland and WA for decades. Now, I'm a history nut. I was going to be a history teacher until I jumped the fence and joined the circus. But I'd never heard these endless frontier horror stories, apart from maybe Tasmania. I've got a dozen more shocking criminal tales of social injustice that are endless, I promise you, but I'll spare you those. Historians now estimate the indigenous population in 1788 may have been as much as 700,000 Aboriginal people. Nobody knows for sure. By the early 1900s, the population is said to have dropped to about 70 or 80,000 people. 700,000 to 70,000, 80,000. Oppression and devastation and destruction of Aboriginal society has been the pattern in Australia for almost 250 years. Yet they survived and they thrived, thankfully, and they remember, as I said, all the violence and the social justice, sadly. I suggested earlier that the collective trauma is almost part of the modern Aboriginal dream time. The decency, the social justice, the detail, that's where it lies. It's time, I think, to own up and face the dark history, as Albo called it. After all, today we rightly accept the terrible long-term impact of PTSD across our communities, the debilitating trauma faced by soldiers and emergency workers and even doctors and teachers. That public recognition and therapy today was long overdue in Australia. So what about 2.5 centuries of what Sir William Dean calls dispossession, oppression and degradation? We surely must acknowledge that the extent to which present Indigenous disadvantage flows from the past injustice. Again, they're not my words, they're Sir William Dean's words. Non-Aboriginal Australians and waves of millions of migrants who've made this place their home, many of them from war-torn countries, need to know and understand what really went on here. Details, facts, the truth, it really does matter, I think, as painful as it can be for this lucky country of ours. John Howard, when he was Prime Minister, I was on the Reconciliation Council, Aboriginal Council. I went to see him in his Sydney office. I told him about the appalling chronic diseases that resulted from the lack of clean running water, especially hot water, in dozens of outback communities, and it's still the same today. I told him about Aboriginal women and kids who had to walk from the dry creek beds where they were living to the cattle station house with plastic buckets to collect water, just to drink and to cook and to wash. I told him the lack of water was one of the reasons Fred Hollows had given me in the past for scabies and ear disease and blindness and the rest. Trachoma, which causes blindness, was 5 times greater in Aborigines than in white Australians, where it had been eliminated by 1900. Professor Hollows insisted that being able to wash your face was a basic answer for the disease. Simple as that. Just water to wash your face. Thankfully, the Hollows Foundation has led the campaign drastically cutting the incidence of blindness, certainly trachoma blindness, in Aboriginal Australia. It's one of the very few health success stories we have. But Prime Minister Howard listened again, almost without believing, to these simple facts about the reality of life in regional and outback Australia. He shook his head and he asked what we could do. To Mr. Howard's credit, he agreed to see if the Army Corps of Engineers could start to supply hot and cold running water to some of the most isolated camps. But when he checked with the Defence Department, he discovered the Army Corps of Engineers had been recently disbanded. So nothing happened. Now remember, this was the Prime Minister of Australia, a bright, decent, well-read man who had no idea about the details of poverty and, as a direct result, health, education, housing, jobs, all the stuff that we call social justice. Then most prime ministers, and I've interviewed them all since Menzies, of every political colour are the same. They know little about the realities of Aboriginal Australia, and they do next to nothing. There are not many votes out there. Harold Holt from Toorak is reported to have told his cabinet colleagues that he had never met an Aboriginal person. Gough Whitlam told me that it was only when he was in the Air Force in World War II, in his late 20s, that he first spoke to a black fella in Nhulunbuy up in the Gulf. It was Prime Minister Whitlam, of course, in that iconic photograph back in 1975, who poured the red dust into the palm of Vincent Lingiari, the legendary Aboriginal leader. I'm sure we all remember that. It was the moment which kick-started the whole land rights revolution back in 1975. Years later in Darwin, I watched Gough deliver the second Lingiari Memorial speech the year after Sir William, a speech that Gough called Dragging the Chain, 1887 to 1997. Like a prosecution lawyer, Whitlam forensically dissected what he called the institutionalised procrastination and the entrenched racism of federal parliament since 1901. And Gough spent a fair bit of his life in that parliament. The Australian Constitution, he claimed in that speech, was flawed from the very beginning by the assumption that the Aborigines would quite literally disappear, that they would die out. And amongst a litany of parliamentary sins that Gough refers to is the debate over the Franchise Bill of 1902, when women were given the vote in the federal arena. Hansard records that Henry Higgins KC, who helped draft the Australian Constitution, said it was, quote, utterly inappropriate to grant the franchise to Aborigines or ask them to exercise an intelligent vote, unquote. And Sir Isaac Isaacs, from here, declared that the Aborigines have not the intelligence, interest or capacity to enable them to stand on the same platform with the rest of the people in Australia, quote unquote. Aboriginal Australians, Gough reported, got less than a minute of discussion in that historic franchise debate back in 1902. Whitlam also listed, I should say that both Higgins and Isaacs, of course, went on to become justices of the High Court in Australia. Isaacs was made Chief Justice before controversially becoming the first Australian-born Governor-General. And that was their position on race in Australia. Whitlam also listed chapter and verse how Canberra, amongst other countless sins, refused to give both the maternity allowance and the old age pension to full-blooded Aboriginal people. It simply, quote, wasn't in the interests of the Aborigines, the Treasurer, Richard Casey, told the Parliament in December 1938. Now, he went on to become the Lord Casey, KG, GC, MG, CH, DSO, MC, PC, whatever that means. And he was also the Governor General a few years later. Of course, as Whitlam reminds us, Aboriginal people weren't even counted in the census until 1967. They simply didn't exist in Australia. Now, it's all in the details. The reason I've sort of bored you with this is it's a woeful fact, a scandalous injustice of our First Nations people. Forget the politicians for a moment. The recent polls have shown that 6 out of 10 ordinary Australians have never met an Aboriginal person. 6 out of 10. Apart from cheering, obviously, and jeering some of them on the football field. So a few years ago, I did 2 series of TV shows from SBS called First Contact. We visited the Aboriginal jail, there is one, up in Derby. It's called the West Kimberley Regional Prison. It was built back in 2012 for so-called mild or medium offenders. Someone who should know told me at the time that it costs taxpayers about $250,000 a year to keep a single prisoner locked up, even for mild crimes. $250,000 a year. Now, how crazy is that? No government spends that kind of money on education resources. In Aboriginal Australia or anybody else, anywhere else, nothing like it. Yet I'm convinced after all these years, if there is a silver bullet in tackling Indigenous poverty and problems, then it has to be education. It always has been. For communities everywhere, for white and black, for me it certainly was. But $250,000 plus per Aboriginal prisoner. That's more than it costs for a life-changing scholarship to one of Australia's finest boarding high schools for 6 years. There are currently 430 Aboriginal boys and girls on AIEF scholarships around Australia in the best schools, the Australian Indigenous Education Foundation. This is a good news story, I promise you, the best of social justice through education. I was chairman of the foundation for its first 4 years and I know the story. It's a not-for-profit charity supported by a wide range of banks and miners and business houses and individuals in Australia. And now, after 18 years, it's a remarkable success story. They have more than 1,000 graduates who've gone through those scholarships. The girls and boys come from damaged and disadvantaged homes. They've achieved Year 12 completion rates that are higher than non-Indigenous students around Australia, at 94% completion rate. As I said, it's life-changing stuff. It's social justice being delivered by the Australian community. Let me tell you a quick story from the earliest days of that foundation. I was in Toowoomba talking to a group of maybe 12 girls on the AIF scholarship at a church school up there. I was asking them what they wanted to do, you know, what their dreams were, these girls who were out of underprivileged homes. Their answers mostly covered nursing or teaching, some business, some law. And I asked one bright, beautiful, fresh and innocent 13-year-old girl what she dreamed of. She'd come from one of the camps just outside of Toowoomba. Now, I knew she'd come from, you know, a particularly difficult childhood and family, lots of trauma and troubles, not much support. Well, she said, smiling and her eyes sparkling at me, "I'll tell you what I dream of," she said. "I dream of being a surgeon. But if I can't be a surgeon, I'd love to be a hairdresser." Now, I didn't laugh. I told her that she would be a great surgeon or a fantastic hairdresser. But the powerful point, the moral of that story, if you like, is that the scholarship, the chance at education, gave her a reason, a right to be able to dream. She could dream. She couldn't dream back in her community. She didn't have that before any time in her short life. I guess what I'm trying to say is when it comes to social justice, and I've been talking tonight about reconciliation, there's a genuine community role to be played. We're all responsible. And you're responsible for the way you treat people. You're responsible for the way that you act towards others. It's up to us, obviously, to stop racism, to stomp on it wherever it raises its ugly head, at a footy game or at school or at work. Let me finish with a story about health. It's also about social justice in the end, is health, obviously. By now, I think everybody knows that Indigenous people are the sickest Australians. Again, it's all about poverty. Their life expectancy is about 20 years less than the rest of us. They have the highest suicide rates, the worst rates of everything, from diabetes to ear and skin infections, through renal failure to rheumatic fever, which is the highest in the world, by the way, not just in the isolated outback, but in regional Australia too. Rheumatic fever that kills kids. We hear the same shocking statistics year after year, but nothing changes, or very little. I mentioned earlier a remarkable warm story from Catherine that I wanted to talk to you about. It's my last story, I promise. Bob Holt is a truck driver and an owner of trucks who carts cement up and down the Sturt Highway to Darwin four times a week. He's 83 and he's built like a jockey. He read something called the Good Egg magazine, published to promote the Humpty Dumpty Foundation. Now, Humpty's a Sydney-based charity that raises money for children's hospitals and clinics right around Australia. But in recent times, they've concentrated on the Northern Territory, trying to close the gap in Indigenous health. I've been the patron from the beginning of Humpty's life, and that's how I know this particular story. Anyway, a couple of years ago, Bob rang our chairman. He said, "I'm sitting on the dunny in my Catherine house. I'm reading your charity magazine, and I want to give you some money for kids in hospital here in Catherine." "That's wonderful, Bob. How much would you like to give?" "Well, I want to give you $10,000. He did the same the second year, again, just for the kids at Catherine Hospital. He's a white fella. Nobody donates money for Catherine Hospital, I've got to tell you, not even the governments, and certainly they don't donate very much. Anyway, the third year, he said he wanted to give a little more. "How much, Bob?" "I want to give $1 million. And he did. He gave $1 million. When I asked him why, he told me, "I don't want to die as the richest man in the cemetery, but I also want to make a difference for kids," he said. He knew it was mostly Aboriginal kids that he was making a difference to. His generosity will make an enormous difference in the health of kids around the Barkly Tablelands, most of them Aboriginal, amongst the sickest kids anywhere in Australia. That's clearly a positive act of social justice. It's got nothing to do with governments.
Journalist, TV icon, reconciliation advocate, Ray Martin, with the 2025 Joan Kerner Social Justice Oration, presented in Naarm, Melbourne, at the Communities in Control Conference. Big thanks to the teams behind both of the special orations we've brought you today. And you'll have your thoughts, our email, bigideas@abc.net.au. We love reading your letters. And if you'd like to share today's show with friends, you can do that from ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Big Ideas, hit follow to get all our shows. And next on the program, scientist Tim Flannery on why he's such a fanboy of the philosopher Jeremy Bentham, the inventor of the panopticon. Later in the week, you'll also hear from the incredible Neela Ibrahimi, 20 years old, from Afghanistan, winner of the International Children's Peace Prize, on how a song became a movement. I'll catch you then. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.